Well, you know, if you tune in every Monday, it's Eve Prang-Plues blathering on about something that has to do with food or toxins or health. And I have to tell you, I was very provoked by Jane Brody's column that appeared about 2 weeks ago in the Sarasota Herald. And it was talking about unwanted pounds. And all we have to do is open our eyes and we will see that there are very many unwanted pounds. But she did a little memoir in here of what it was like when she was growing up. And even though she beats me by a number of years, there were a lot of things that were really similar in Jane Brody's background to my own background. So I will use her column as a launch point for this issue of No Nonsense Nutrition. And if you ever miss a No Nonsense Nutrition and you want to hear it again, you can go up on eveplues.com and listen to the podcasts from prior shows. I grew up right here on the west coast of Florida in Pinellas County and was definitely a small town girl. And what was true is there weren't any vending machines, you know, dispensing candy and soda. There were no fast food emporiums anywhere around. There were no shopping malls that had food courts when I was growing up. We certainly weren't bombarded with television all the time because until I was 6 years old, we didn't have any television in Pinellas County. And then the very first station started. And so that one station, it was, you know, something that we watched. I mean, I loved watching Ed Sullivan on Sunday night and watching, you know, all of the kids' shows on Saturday morning. But it wasn't like we sat around the television for 6 hours a day noshing down on Doritos, which is what I see going on. And nor was I exposed to television commercials that had nothing but, you know, sugar-laden drinks and fat and salt-laden chips in it. You know, we had milk every day at school on our lunch tray. And so even if we had cookies after school, my mother didn't really want to see me again until it got dark. And so we ran around and played and we rode our bicycle and, you know, we were out in the palmettos making palmetto houses. And, you know, it was a very cool childhood for me. You know, I learned by probably age 6 or 7 which snakes were dangerous and which ones to stay away from when we were out in the woods. But the meals that I grew up with were prepared and eaten at home, even though, you know, both of my parents were working. My father had a job. My mother was volunteering herself to death in the community. She didn't get a paying job until I was about 16 years old, but eating out was a really special event when I was growing up. You know, if you want to talk about convenience food, that was a can of green beans. I mean, it wasn't the fact that you could pick up the phone and call Pizzaville and get something delivered. And there was certainly not a freezer full of tater tots and frozen lasagnas. And, you know, breakfast was typically some cold cereal. It wasn't a Pop-Tart or a 500-calorie bagel that looked like a truck tire with 200 calories of cream cheese smeared on the top of it. I had to go a long way to get an ice cream. I mean, it must have been at least a 3-mile bike ride into the center of the village for some place that you could go get an ice cream. Well, we've had a lot of energy-saving devices since then. You know, with all of the gizmos we have from electric can openers to vacuum cleaners to, you know, leaf blowers, we've decreased the amount of calories that we actually need to burn because the energy requirements for daily life have decreased substantially. Now I see people in the parking lot driving around for 20 minutes looking for someplace 30 feet closer to the door. So when we put that together, we can see that Americans' weights really stayed stable up until about the 1970s. And then something really remarkable happened. There's an Australian researcher by the name of Boyd Swinburne who's really done a tremendous amount of research worldwide, and he calls the 1970s the tipping point because more women began to enter the workforce and the food industry noticed. And they started creating mass-produced convenience foods with palate appeal. These foods were rich in salt and sugar and fat because salt and sugar and fat are things that, from an evolutionary standpoint, we're designed to crave. If you look at native diets around the world, they're very low in fat. In fact, when an animal was killed by the native population, the fat was always given to the chief because it was so rare. You know, sugar was unheard of, and salt was pretty difficult to get. And you need enough salt in order to keep your nervous system working well. So suddenly women were spending a lot less time on food preparation, and the food industry figured out how to make that food more readily available for everybody, especially by loading it with sugar and salt and fat. The industry really made it a whole lot easier for people to consume more calories throughout the day. In the meantime, the era of television began to boom, and we started getting commercial after commercial after commercial telling us that these cheap, tasty foods that could clearly make us obese were something that we needed to have in our diet. You put all of those factors together. We did less exercise, and it wasn't exercise as exercise. It was just exercise as chores. We walked less. We rode our bike less. The kids weren't out playing as much. You know, today, American children spend as much as 6 hours a day in front of a screen. You know, if I had 90 minutes in front of a television when I was a kid growing up, it would be novel. Well, what are we going to do about it? I mean, what are we going to do about the fact that America just continues to grow, and every single solitary advertisement, it seems, in magazines and in the newspaper is about losing weight or eating fat, sugary, salty foods. It's like there's a certain kind of schizophrenia that's going on. Well, you know, I can look back to the interventions that really worked to drive down the smoking rates to in the 20% zone from the near 50% zone. When I was growing up, my parents both smoked two packs of Raleighs a day, and so did Grandma, and so did Uncle Ed, and so did Uncle Al, and so did, you know, it was always around me. And in those days, you didn't smoke outside. And in those days, the kids sat in the back seat of the car and both of the parents were smoking in the front seat. That was what I was exposed to. And the first move that we made was to ban all of the advertising for tobacco on the television. And then tobacco taxes were increased. And then smoking began to be banned in more and more places. You know, nicotine gum and nicotine patches were released so that people could deal with the nicotine addiction, even though that's only one part of the cigarette addiction. The other part is the habit. So the decline in smoking didn't happen overnight. And if we take that same model and we apply it to obesity and overweight, we may want to look at that model as a way to change the obesity epidemic, because what's true is this is what's going to bankrupt our healthcare system and our government. The issue is not all of the nonsense that the Congress is squabbling about. It's all about the fact that we are creating a country of diabetics. And remember, diabetes speeds heart disease by 400%. And what we're seeing now is that the term adult onset diabetes isn't even being used anymore, because we're seeing adult onset diabetes in children. So when we look at the health-saving measures that can be done, the first health-saving measure would be to put a tax on unhealthy foods. You know, if we only put a penny an ounce tax on sugar-sweetened soft drinks, we'd throw $1 billion into the Florida coffers. because children from age 2 to age 19, and yes, I have seen 2-year-olds with a soda pop in their hand, they drink 7 trillion calories. 7 trillion calories every year just for kids. That's a $24 billion industry just for kids alone. That's a big, huge tax base. You know, the state of California could get $1.5 billion a year just from taxing soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages at a penny an ounce. Some of the policymakers that are really looking at this issue, especially a guy by the name of Stephen Gortmaker, who's a sociologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, he says that a 10% tax on unhealthy foods and drinks would make a huge difference, that a more obvious label on foods would make a difference. In other words, he suggested the red and yellow or green traffic light on package fronts and the reduction of advertising of junk foods and beverages to children. You know, we don't have babies that are born obese, but they're growing up in an obesogenic environment. Yeah, that's a new word to me, too, an obesogenic environment. And for those children who become obese by age 10 or 11, and I've seen 2 of them in my practice just in the last 2 weeks, you're pretty well guaranteeing that you're going to end up with an obese adult. You know, if we do nothing but tax the sugar drinks, which I consider to be a no-brainer, not only because of the issues that are going on with the budget, but because that we've repeatedly demonstrated that when we tax things, we reduce their uses. And so, you know, those people that are espousing the nonsense about don't let the government get in your personal life, let's talk to them about what they're doing about availability of health care for people that are on Medicaid. Let's talk to them about women's rights in terms of their reproductive health. You know, talk about the government meddling in people's affairs. So, you know, when people make the statement the government shouldn't interfere with our personal choices, then, you know, we wouldn't have speed limits on the road. We wouldn't be required to buy insurance. And I'm not talking about health insurance. I'm talking about car insurance. So, yes, there have been some reductions in unhealthy food advertisements on children's television, but the decline has been pretty minimal. And, you know, this overweight and obese problem is not just a United States problem. The effect is starting to be seen globally. And so, you know, even the UN General Assembly is going to focus on the epidemic of global obesity in this next term. Well, what does that have to do with you? Well, it has a lot to do if you're raising kids, and it has a lot to do if you happen to be one of those individuals that's got a little bit more belly than you'd like to have, and that certainly makes a list for a whole lot of us. And so then they turn around and they come out with a study that says junk food beckons because money is tight. That economists and health researchers and consumers together are struggling with a food price rising and an economy slumping. And, you know, you haven't even seen the beginning of food price rising. So even middle class people struggle to put healthful food on the table. We know that junk food and cheap food are often the same thing. That because of the fact that our federal government subsidizes the corn industry, and the corn industry is what we use to make high fructose corn syrup, and the corn industry allows us to fatten cattle at a cheaper price than would happen if the subsidies weren't affected there. And so as a result of these things, we can make burgers for a dollar that are very high in saturated fat, very high in overall toxic load, and do not have the concentration of nutrients that we need. They're high calorie, but they're not necessarily high nutrient. You know, so we have to look for a grocery list that can cut food prices at the same time that it boosts nutrition. Because if we're going to affect the obesity epidemic, it's not going to just happen as a result of taxing soda pop. You know, when we look at junk food versus fresh, we have to look at short term and long term. Because what's true is if you've only got $5 in your pocket and you've got a family to feed, the idea that you are going to pick up fresh, organic, locally grown fruits and vegetables isn't going to happen. I think we have to start with teaching kids about shopping and preparing food in school, even like I had in home ec classes in the eighth grade. You know, food preparation can be integrated into a whole range of classes in school. You can learn about ecology from examining the way that animals and plants are raised. You can learn about cultures by examining their menus. You can study the denaturing of protein if you stir fry a chicken. You can learn about biology and bacterial growth by what happens when you store stuff in a refrigerator. The examples are really limitless. But to try to convince individuals that preparing nutritious food is cheaper and healthier, it's going to be a tough crawl. You know, if you can just go to the drive-thru and plunk down your $2 and get something to eat, a lot of people wouldn't be very interested in going home and soaking beans and, you know, hand-making tortillas. Because more meal preparation time has to be allocated if we're going to eat cheaper and we're going to eat healthier food at the same time. And that's really the goal of this no-nonsense nutrition show, is to look at how can we eat cheaper and healthier. Well, we have to start looking for some cheap foods that are good for you, and I always have to start right away with canned salmon. You know, every bit of salmon that comes out of a can is wild-caught salmon. So when I look at salmon in a can and when I look at tuna in a can, the only other territory that I can go to that I can get as much protein for as low a price are eggs. And you've heard here on No Nonsense Nutrition on many occasions that I'm a huge endorser of eggs, not only because they're the cheapest usable protein that we have. You know, there's something that we measure in science called NPU, net protein utilization. Not how much protein is in the food, but how much protein can your body utilize. And eggs have a 96 to 98% NPU, depending on how hard they're cooked. The harder the egg is cooked, the lower the NPU. Doesn't make hard-boiled eggs bad. In fact, I had an egg salad sandwich yesterday as my breakfast when I had the great joy of getting out on beautiful Sarasota Bay. But soft-cooked eggs give you more availability of those good fats that are in the egg yolk. And you know I'm a huge fan of that fat that's in egg yolks, because we don't have very many other sources for it in the American diet unless we're eating liver and heart and kidneys, other organ meats, which I don't recommend unless they've come from an animal raised organically. But eggs are full of nutrients. They're high in protein. They're low in price. You can fix them a million ways. I have eggs for breakfast about 4 days a week, but, you know, the egg can go on top of the spinach salad. The egg can be an egg salad sandwich at lunch. It can be an omelet for dinner. It can be a frittata. And so it's the same thing with canned salmon and canned tuna. These are very inexpensive ways for us to get really high-quality protein. And remember that the best of the tuna is the light tuna, which is cheaper than the white tuna or the albacore. White tuna or albacore has 6 times the amount of mercury that light tuna has in it. So when we're looking for cheap foods that are good for you, you can watch your wallet and your waistline at the same time when you're looking at things like canned salmon, canned tuna, and eggs as a protein source. And by the time that we add chicken breast to that list, easy to prepare, full of lean protein, and oftentimes just the whole chicken is a whole lot cheaper. I'm much more a fan of buying the whole chicken and cooking the whole chicken, simply because of the fact that the cost per pound for the meat is as low as it possibly can be. Those are the healthiest, cheapest sources of protein until we get to the bean kingdom and we talk about natural peanut butter. Skip the sugary processed varieties and spread the real stuff on whole grain bread. You know, peanuts are really not a nut. They're a bean. They're a leguminaceae. Nuts grow on trees. Peanuts grow in the ground. They're beans. And when you have a bean and a grain together, especially in the same meal, any kind of bean and grain combination. You know, when you think of cultures around the world, when you go to Mexico, you have refried beans on a tortilla. When you go to Scotland, it's white beans in an oat cake. When you go to the Middle East, you have hummus and pita. When you go to Asia, you have tofu and rice. Anytime we put together a bean and a grain, we get complete protein. So when we put natural peanut butter on whole grain bread, yum. You know, we can take natural peanut butter and use it as a dip for carrots or celery. Mix it with a little bit of low-sodium soy sauce and a little bit of garlic and even a little bit of brown sugar, and you've got a really yummy sauce that's very cheap to fix. Peanut butter, soy sauce, brown sugar, and garlic. And if you want the hot sauce like the Thais use as their pepper sauce, just throw some cayenne in there. Canned beans, another place that we can get cheap protein. You know, if you don't like kidneys or pintos, try black beans and chickpeas. You know, cumin is the best of the spices for a bean. So, you know, if you drain them and rinse them and throw them in the blender or the Cuisinart, the food processor, with a little bit of lemon juice and a little bit of cumin, and you just made a terrific dip. And if you like garlic or a wedge of onion, put that in there as well. No, it's not hummus, because hummus contains tahini or sesame butter. But it is a delicious quick dip that you can put the carrots or the pretzels or the celery or the snow peas or whatever into it. You can spread it on a tortilla. You can stuff it in a pita. So there are very many inexpensive proteins, from canned salmon to canned tuna, from chicken breast to eggs, from natural peanut butter to canned beans, that you can add into the diet. And don't forget dried lentils. You know, dried lentils are full of protein and full of fiber, and they cook in a really short period of time. Lentils are one of the beans that you don't have to pre-soak. You don't have to pre-soak split peas, and you don't have to pre-soak lentils. The bigger, heavier beans, actually, you don't have to pre-soak them either. You just have to cook them longer. Pre-soaking is just designed to reduce the costs of your fuel and your cooking time. And then last on the protein list, I would probably add almonds, because almonds have one of the best prices for the nuts that are out there, and plus you get vitamin E, and there aren't a lot of foods that have vitamin E in them. Not only that, you're going to get some fiber and you get some protein, and you're going to satisfy that crunchy craving. Nuts are rich in amino acids that are linked to heart benefits, that good old arginine. You know, chop a few of them, put them on the salad, chop a few and throw them in the yogurt. Do what my husband does. Spread them on a cookie tray, put them in the toaster oven, and just put it on toast and warm them through just a little bit. It gives them a lovely, delightful added taste. Oh, I guess there is one more thing that I can add on the protein list, and that's powdered whey. You know, whey is a byproduct of taking milk and separating out the curds to make cheese. Remember Little Miss Muffet when she sat on her tuffet? That's a footstool, by the way. Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey. And so when you curdle milk, the curds become the cheese, and the whey is the leftover source of protein. That whey can be stirred into your oatmeal, it can be put into your smoothie, it can be stirred into your yogurt, it can be made into a protein drink. There's lots of ways to use whey. So, yes, there are cheap foods that are good for you. We don't have to be boogieing through the drive-thru. You know, when we look at fruits and vegetables, it was interesting. I had a student in one of my new classes, new client classes here a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking about the fact that the peaches, apricots, plums, cherries, pluot season was just about over, and that we had moved into the apple, grape, pear time of year. And he said, well, do you have a chart that tells us when things grow? And I realize how many people are so far away from their food that they don't really know the seasons of the foods. But every single month, there are the cheapest fruits and vegetables available, and that's a chart that's available to you if you just Google in cheapest fruits and vegetables. In October, it's certainly apples and pears, along with grapes, cranberries, sweet potatoes, pumpkins, winter squash, broccoli. October is broccoli month for sure. Spinach and lettuce. Those are the places that you're going to get the cheapest, or the species that are going to be the cheapest in the month of October. So when you are dedicated to a healthy diet and cooking at home, you drive your menu around the things that are least expensive at that time of the year. You know, with broccoli being so cheap in October, it really is the peak month. Broccoli salad, broccoli slaw, broccoli soup. So, you want my favorite broccoli soup recipe? It's really easy. It's called the 4-2-1 recipe. We take 4 cups of broccoli tops, 2 cups of white potato peeled, and 1 cup of onions. And just put enough water to just cover it and simmer it for about 20 minutes and then put it in the food processor or the blender or take your potato masher to it and squish it up as best as you can. Throw in a little bit of white pepper. And if you've got some half and half or you've got some soy milk, not vanilla, of course, you can put a little splash in there to make it a little bit creamier. But actually, I don't do anything else to it. 4 parts of broccoli, 2 parts of potato, and 1 part of onion. I love it like that. And if you have to have broccoli cheese soup, choose those low-fat, sharp cheddars, because then you're going to get a lot of flavor without so much fat. So when sweet potatoes and pumpkins and winter squashes are high, then, you know, we can make soups out of those. We can make hash browns out of them. We can put the sweet potato in our pancake mix and make, or pumpkin, and make pumpkin pancakes. Take advantage of the things that are as cheap as possible during the season. But essentially, it's apple, grapes, and pear time, and actually pomegranates. Pomegranates, I was actually surprised last week when I went in the market that I didn't see them there, because I usually see them right about the 1st of October. And yes, they are a pricier fruit, but I treat myself to a few of them now and then. Frozen fruits and berries are another way that you can save money. Bananas, you don't get much cheaper. You know, bananas on average are 25 to 35 cents for each one. Nice potassium-rich banana up there with the nice potassium-rich potatoes. And so taking a handful of those grapes and throwing them in the freezer, especially the dark purple ones that have so many antioxidants in them. And those frozen grapes are a nice little low-calorie dessert or a snack. You know, when we look at vegetables, there isn't going to be anything that's going to get cheaper than cabbage. But when we look at onions and sweet potatoes and canned tomatoes and frozen spinach and carrots, we can find vegetables that are pretty low in cost and very, very high in nutrients. You know, that bright beta carotene that makes carrots orange, Mom was right, they are good for your eyes. You know, dipping them in natural peanut butter, nothing better. Canned tomatoes, cheap, cheap, cheap. You know, you can puree a can of stewed tomatoes and just throw in some milk and you just made your own cream of tomato soup. You get a dose of vitamin A and a dose of vitamin B and a dose of vitamin C and an antioxidant called lycopene that's known to prevent cancer. You know, you can use them to make pasta sauces. You can throw it in the chili to stretch a meal. Canned tomatoes are a very inexpensive way to get a lot of nutrient for a lot, not a lot of cost. And onions, those of you regular listeners to No Nonsense Nutrition know that I am a big fan of onions. This smelly vegetable is full of health benefits. They lower risk of certain cancers. They add a lot of flavor with very few calories. Try roasting them to bring out their sweetness. Take an onion, wrap it up in aluminum foil, stick it in a very low oven, like a 250-degree oven, for about an hour. And then after you take them out and peel them and throw them in the food processor with either an equal amount of olive oil or an equal amount of butter, and make onion butter out of it, put that on a baked potato. You've got a very inexpensive, lovely treat. Broccoli is another one that's going to be cheap this month. Don't forget it. Full of fiber, loaded with vitamin A as beta carotene and vitamin C, plenty of antioxidants. One of my favorite compounds, sulforaphane glucosinolate. I know if you're a regular listener to No Nonsense Nutrition, you've heard me talk about sulforaphane before. You know, broccoli is the superstar in the nutrition world with that ingredient. You want to save money on whole grains? Look at popcorn. You know, air pop popcorn, barely a trace of fat, hardly even 30 calories in a big old cup. And you can sprinkle your favorite seasonings on it. My friend Brooke Medicine Eagle used to drive cross country from one reservation to another, and she used to take a whole bunch of parsley and cut it up over the popcorn, and that was her treat when she was driving. So you like the Italian palate? Put some garlic salt and a little oregano on it. You like the Greek palate? Throw a little bit of basil in there. There's ways that you can take popcorn kernels and make them into all sorts of things besides just movie food. Brown rice, oats, and whole grain pasta are about as cheap as we get in terms of high nutrient content, high amounts of fiber, and very low costs. You know, anytime you mix a cup of cooked rice with a half a pound of any kind of ground meat to make a meatloaf, you not only save some money, but you save some fat, and it's pretty delicious. Don't think of oatmeal only for breakfast. You know, if you cook steel-cut oats and chicken broth, you end up with one delicious side dish. And when I make meatloaf out of ground turkey, I always add a half a cup of oatmeal into it to stretch my meatloaf or stretch the meatballs. So that's another idea besides brown rice that you can add to the meat to stretch your budget and still get high concentration of nutrients. Don't buy yogurt in the little containers. Always buy quarts. When you buy large containers of plain or vanilla yogurt and add real fruit, you'll save money and calories by not buying the fancy single-serve yogurts. And when you buy milk by the gallon, you know, it's full of calcium and protein and, you know, can help to stretch a meal. You know, this is one where I'm pretty insistent about organic. And happily, the organic milk has gotten down close to the price of regular milk. So there are ways that we can get much higher nutrition at lower costs. You know, using frozen vegetables, using frozen berries and fruits, they're always there. You don't ever have to worry. You know, when people say to me, I have to throw stuff out because I can't use it up before it goes bad. Well, you can save that problem by buying it in bulk and buying it in a frozen form. You know, when people say they have to cut their food budget, the first thing I tell them to do is switch to water. Get rid of the soda pop and the other, you know, fancy coffee drinks. It's healthier, it's cheaper. Of course I want you to filter it. But the nature of water is even consuming regular tap water, whether it's got toxins in it or not, is still healthier than drinking soda pop. You know, half the bottled water companies get their supply from the same source you do, which is a municipal water system. Talk about selling ice to Eskimos. If you don't trust the quality of tap water, filter it yourself. When we look at eating healthy and these statements that say it's going to cost us a whole lot more, I think that we can avoid it costing a whole lot more. When more than 20% of Americans say that they don't eat the way they want to because they don't have the money to do it, what they need is ideas. And so when we take these ideas and do the rubber meets the road thing, you know, when we buy that pound of brown rice that costs less than $2, and we realize that we can have, you know, everything from fried rice to rice salads to side dishes to casseroles to soups to stews, that it's an incredible stretcher for so many things on our table. The same thing is true with dried pasta. You know, buying whole wheat bread, remember, every time you look at the label, you want the very first ingredient to be whole wheat, not enriched flour. If it says enriched flour, then it's just white bread with a suntan. So when you begin to base your shopping list around these simple foods, you'll find out that you can reduce your grocery bill and increase your nutrient concentration, and as a result, create some resistance to this ever-growing waistline of America. You know, even very resolute dieters have failed because we've used a naive formula for a long time. That naive formula is that, you know, we could reduce 3,500 calories and lose a pound. And so if you took out 500 calories a day, you'd lose a pound a week. Well, it turns out that's pretty incorrect. There was a beautiful study that was done at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases by Dr. Kevin Hall. And they've created a much more realistic model of how the body responds to calories and how people of different weight respond to caloric changes. Their new study was published in The Lancet, the British medical journal, and it helps to explain a great deal about how some people can lose weight faster than others, even when they're eating the same foods and doing the same exercise. You know, lasting weight loss takes a long time, and it suggests that the more effective weight loss programs might be undertaken in two phases. The temporary aggressive change, you know, I want to get down to a size whatever by the dance, and a relaxed but long-term permanent behavior change that can prevent the weight regain that afflicts so many dieters, even the ones that have the best intentions in the world. You know, it's easy to gain weight unwittingly from a very small imbalance in the number of calories consumed over the calories that are used. You know, I can testify to that. I hurt my foot. And when I hurt my foot, I stopped walking because I couldn't. I didn't change how I ate. But what's true is I probably should have taken 200 calories out of my diet every day that I wasn't doing my walking. And so the pounds didn't fly on, the ounces did. And by the time that my foot was better and I went back to walking, I was 8 pounds heavier. So Dr. Hall says that we have to stop assuming that we can just go on a diet and, you know, take 500 calories out of our, you know, food choices every day and do that for a month and we'll lose 4 pounds. The more realistic result is a lot slower, but a lot more permanent. If we took out 250 calories a day, the amount in a half a cup of fancy ice cream or a, you know, a little chocolate bar, we'd lose 25 pounds over 3 years. Well, nobody wants to lose 25 pounds over 3 years. Everybody wants to lose 25 pounds by Christmas. Now, half that loss would occur in the first year. People would lose an average of a pound a month. And then lesser amounts, maybe 8 pounds the next year and 4 pounds the next year, but the idea being we'd get to 25 pounds in 3 years. The heavier somebody is, the more calories they have to cut to lose weight. But for the population of America to return to the average body weight that we had in the 1970s, we got some work to do. Typical weight loss programs show significant losses over a period of the first 6 or 8 months, and then a gradual weight regain in the years that follow. So when weight loss plateaus on a dieting program at 6 or 8 months, that's when we need to go to these long-term strategies. Just taking out that one extra piece of bread every day. You know, if you take 10 calories out per day for every pound that you want to lose, if you want to lose 10 pounds, you got to take out 100 calories a day. If you want to lose 20 pounds, you got to take out 200 calories a day. Then we're looking at a long-term strategy that's going to work. The other thing that we can do is look at the physical activity side of the scale. You know, many people have said that physical activity doesn't have a lot of effect on weight loss, but that's not what showed up in Dr. Hall's model. You know, when we looked at individuals who added fitness into their regimen, they did lose weight faster, but moreover, they got healthier as a result of the physical activity. Their heart rate came down, meaning their heart wasn't working so hard. Their blood pressure came down, so they were protecting their brain and their kidneys. And so physical activity does remain important to weight loss, and especially to weight maintenance. You know, there were 5,000 participants that were in the National Weight Control Registry. These are people who lost a significant amount of weight and kept it off for many years. They primarily relied on two tactics. One of them was continuous physical activity, and the other one is regular checks on body weight. When I get people in my office and I say, how much do you weigh? And they say, oh, I don't know, I haven't been on a scale forever. That is not the smartest thing to do. You know, you've got people who talk about low carb, high protein, and you've got people that talk about low fat, and you've got people that talk about low calorie. Low carb diets do a little more to reduce more weight over the first 6 months that somebody's on a program. But what's true is that overall, it's just got to be lower calories than you were eating before. It isn't always the balance between them, it's the total of them. So when we begin to put all of this stuff together, you got a kid that you don't want to make into a round child, get them active. Cut their screen time down to 2 hours a day, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's a computer or a television. Kids need to be doing what kids are designed to do, which is run, move, play, jump, dance, get on the swings, do something. Do something that's making you active. Over and over again, we see that the kids that are the most active are the kids that have the least ability to be gaining extra pounds. And so that's what you want. That's what I want. Certainly here for America, then activity is one of the things you want to encourage your kids to do, and maybe you need to do it right along with them.